And welcome to the latest episode of Who Do You Think You Are, the brand new podcast series by A3 Communications, the data storage industry PR agency. My name is Fred Monson, and I'm the founder and CEO. Today, I am very excited to bring you a very special guest, someone who has been bringing an unparalleled blend of technology expertise, successful communications, and business acumen, all combined with a contagious positivity and energy. In the Who Do You Think You Are guest chair today is none other than Molly Presley. Hello, Molly. Welcome to our podcast. How are you?
I'm doing great. What a lovely introduction. Thank you, Fred.
You're very welcome. It was all true. I had to cut it short, actually, because I was going on and on and on a bit too much. We've known each other for many years, and we've worked together several times. You've held multiple senior marketing roles, including that of CMO, and have been an instrumental executive in a number of companies, including Spectralogic, Quantum, DDN, Cumulo, and now Hammerspace. Why did you become a comms specialist, and how long have you been in this line of work?
You know, it's interesting. I kind of fell on it that one of the things I've found is successful marketing leadership, especially in the tech industry, if you come from a more technical background, helps you a lot. You're able to really understand and relate with the technical writers, really understand how the product differentiation makes a difference to an end user or to a buyer. So I actually started there, and I didn't intend to be a comms professional. That was something that sort of happened naturally through my career. But what I found was I initially was being pulled into conversations with analysts, bloggers, journalists to give a pitch or a message about a product. And they found that the journalists actually preferred to talk to me versus the, you know, higher level marketing folks in the organization because I had a better understanding of the technology differentiation. So it's kind of bit by bit, I ended up doing comms more and more, and eventually in the seat of running the marketing team have continued to have the opportunity to do that.
And I would say that you are one of the people who gives the CMO job title a good name, because very often the press in particular is not keen to talk to executives that have marketing in their job title. However, I find that often CMOs do have quite a high level of understanding of the technology, which is critical because marketing is so intrinsically linked to sales that if the person in charge of developing the brand, developing the messaging, talking to the company's audience doesn't understand the technology very well, they won't be able to create a strategy that will effectively support sales, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think the role of CMO has changed a lot in the couple of decades that I've been working. When I first became familiar with that job title, it was largely events marketing, you know, brand marketing. What are the emotions, the colors, the feelings you want to express from your brand? What are the events that you're doing? Those types of things. And in the last 20 years, the role of the CMO has changed a lot. It's a digital first world. So event marketing and how you show up in an event and make the biggest splash really is not all that important anymore. And I mean, it matters, of course, but how you present yourself to the world in a digital fashion means you have to understand what are the terms customers are looking for, what are the solutions that they want to solve, what are the pain points that they have. And if you can't address that, you won't come up in their Google searches and you won't have a way to interact and communicate with them. And so I think that that CMO job has expanded dramatically. And in order to do all of those customer-facing digital roles, you have to have a great relationship with your sales team and understand when they're out in the field and having that first call or having landing that first inquiry. We understand, are we landing leads with the right user, the right persona, with the right pain points? And so the role has really evolved to being very customer-centric, very pain point-centric, and very product-centric.
It certainly is. And another thing I would say that you briefly mentioned earlier is the fact that it's all about differentiating what you do from what the competition does, because nowadays, if you look at the data storage industry as, say, an end user where you don't have, say, a data storage administrator, but you may have an infrastructure role or someone a little bit more general because maybe they are not a massive organization, they will look at what's on offer and think it's all much of a muchness. They all do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they do. You know, it's get me more performance, do it, you know, cheaper. The key for the marketing organization is really to differentiate the details that lead to making the product stand out. So would you say that it is critical for a storage vendor nowadays to make sure they bring to the fore why they are different? Because otherwise,
yeah, absolutely.
They can easily be, you know, confused with someone else.
Yeah, it's a tricky line to walk, because if you think about this digital first world, your job is to get people to your website or to your podcast or your webinar, whatever it is that you're promoting. And with search engine optimization or SEO, you're using the terms that you know customers are looking for. The problem is, so is everyone else. And so whether it's NAS or it's database storage or it's ransomware, whatever the keywords are, you know, maybe it's a dark secret of marketing, you use the terms even your company doesn't do to get the people to your site. And so that can be super confusing to a customer when they search for ransomware and land on a site that doesn't look like it has anything to do with ransomware. So very frustrating for a customer, but drives great website metrics. The other side of that you're driving towards is once you get a customer to your site, you have to engage them fast. The whatever books or latest materials you read, you only have a few milliseconds to a few seconds to have the customer look at, see themselves, see their pain point, and engage with what you're doing. So you have to move very quickly on what they see when they get to your site. So if a customer is looking for ransomware and they don't see themselves on that first landing page they come to, or in the first intro seconds or two of a webinar, they're going to drop and go look elsewhere because there's so many choices. So what I've found is you have to kind of divide your way you think in two ways. One, how do you drive volume to the activity or event or website that you're doing? You know, volume does matter, but two, how do you engage them? And that latter part is the part that I think is really where you're touching on, Fred, that the engaging part has to resonate so fast. You can't look like everyone else or else, you know, they're just going to go back to what they know or their legacy solutions, that type of thing, and maybe not really be able to uncover that great new thing that will really help them in their journey to the cloud or something like that, that, you know, everyone markets towards, but you may really have a product that makes a difference. So marketing is difficult in this digital world because you can say anything you want. You know, there's no attorneys who are going to get after you for, you know, using SEO that's not appropriate to your company or, you know, and so customers are, of course.
That would have put a lot of people in trouble.
It would.
When cloud first came out,
because
everyone was jumping on the cloud bandwagon.
Even if they had no offering that had anything to do with it. Yeah, so it's difficult for customers to navigate and there's nothing to hold you accountable. So, you know, long answer to a short question, but for a customer, if you can get great at pain point messaging and understanding what the true pain point is, not the marketing terms, but the true pain point for the IT administrator sitting in the chair, and make sure they understand here's that little bit that solves it. That's where you build, you know, winning marketing teams and successful, you know, growth organizations.
Absolutely. And that also means that if you do your job right as a marketeer, you will get your company, your salespeople will be invited to the right tables. Because I've been in meetings with companies before they became our clients. And when I always ask them, what's the issue? What are the hurdles for your salespeople? I don't really want to know what your problems are with your with your PR yet. I need to understand how, from a PR point of view, we could help your sales teams. And often they say we don't get invited to the right tables because the industry believes we do one thing, but we actually do another. And that brings us back to that need to very clearly explain why you are different, because at the end of the day, the result may be the same, but it's how you get there that means your technology may be more suitable for one user rather than another because of the kind of environment they already have. And I have found that very often when we started working with companies like that, we needed to go back to the drawing board in terms of messaging and positioning, because they had it wrong. They were only looking at it from inside their four walls. They weren't looking at how that would reflect once it was published out into the public domain. And that's definitely an issue at the moment. But you know this because you've been doing that very well for a number of years. What tips would you give a data storage startup with regard to PR? Say they don't have a PR agency, they want to do it in-house, they need to get the bare bones together to get started, and budget is low because they're a startup. Sure. Do you have any top tips?
That's an interesting question. I'll start with what you said about the sales side, that I've run the gauntlet of Fred scrutiny as a PR agency for different companies several times. And you know, you are very critical when you bring on a new client and making sure you understand them. Can you really help them? And I think that's fantastic. You don't just say, oh, lovely, here's some more business, and take on a new client and whatever happens, happens. You know, you're very critical about launching the relationship in the right way. And I think that's great. And I've actually, when I started in comms, learned a lot from that. But moving forward, and you think about what you're talking about on the sales side, any company, big or small, one of the things that we can get stuck in is the feel good of reporting to the board or to the CEO or whoever it is on the number of marketing generated leads that you've created. And the marketing team is patting themselves on the back saying, this is fantastic. I've increased 20% quarter over quarter. And their numbers are magnificent. But if you just look at that and don't look at all the way through the pipeline to how many of those MQLs were accepted by sales, how many moved beyond the first meeting, how many moved on to POC or to close, and understand that whole cycle of why. Okay, so marketing generated, let's say, 1,000 leads, and it only resulted in 2 POCs or sales. That's a serious problem, and you need to investigate why. And it may not be that they were bad marketing leads. It may be something else in the system. But generally speaking, volume doesn't necessarily mean quality. And the sales teams increasingly are smaller and smaller with bigger and bigger quotas. You know, every role is asked to do more with less. And they need to be spending their time focusing on the opportunities that they're most likely to win. And creating a lot of marketing volume, whether it's leads or news stories or coverage or marketing campaigns that don't result in sales, why bother in the end? The whole reason we're all here is to book revenue. And so that kind of comes to the conversation of a comms startup, that I don't really think of my PR agency as a standalone entity who gets news coverage for me and brand awareness. I think of my PR agency, one, as part of my team, and everything we're doing needs to be a part of a campaign. So if I'm running a campaign to a vertical market, let's say life sciences, my PR agency, as well as everybody else on my marketing team, should be thinking about how do we drive our component of that life sciences campaign and to which persona for which use case and why. So if my PR agency doesn't understand that in life sciences, I don't have a pharmaceutical solution because I don't have the right compliance in place, and they're out pitching pharmaceutical articles, that really doesn't help build sales revenue. So I really focus all my teams, whether it's a big company or small, on who are the customers we're trying to get to and what can each individual or agency that's working as part of the team do to increase our likelihood to be found, credible, that type of thing with that type of customer. So, and that can't be done without sales. If you're not super aligned with the sales leader on where the sales team's spending their days, if they're spending their days talking to financial services and you're marketing life sciences, again, that's a big mess.
Absolutely. And I agree. It is so important to make sure that you align with your sales team, even if it's only three people, because they will need you even more. You know, the smaller the team, the more they will need the marketing function to really support them, to prepare. For example, one thing that I often, and we've written a blog on that, and it's on our website, it's about the value of case studies for different stakeholders, including the salespeople, because it's always so hard to get the salespeople engaged to help us get case studies done. But I understand they feel very, very protective of their clients. But you know, I've been doing this and my team for over 20 years. We know how to deal with end users. We know that they're extremely precious. The thing is, the more case studies we can create, the more case studies the sales team will have that they can then take to prospects and say, look, these are other customers in the same boat, and this is what we've done for them. And sometimes the sales team needs to be educated about why they need to work hand in hand in marketing. Marketing knows, usually. But I find sometimes, especially in startups, the sales team really needs to understand why they need to work closely with marketing.
Because I do too. And, you know, case studies are one of those points that, you know, you want to sometimes pull your hair out or have a stiff drink at the end of the day because you can't get them done. It seems like it's for a variety of reasons. But the one tip or pointer that I've found is if marketing does their homework and understands the customer case study, you know, hopefully sales has done a somewhat decent job of writing up a win report or updating their CRM record so you can understand who the personas, who bought it, why they bought it, what pain point, blah, 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 is in place. And you can get a good chunk of the write-up done with the work sales already was told to do by their sales leaders. That goes a long way, that they're not having to start from scratch. And then when you get to the point of it's time to talk to the customer, you know, small companies, you don't have customer advocacy and all those roles that are kind of purpose-built for this. You know, let the sales team run it with the customer if they want to. Have technical people on with customers so the sales team doesn't feel embarrassed that, you know, I air quote, you know, that a marketing person is asking questions that aren't relevant. And, you know, it quickly will build trust if the sales team goes, okay, I'm not having to do redundant work. The person talking to the customer actually understands the workload. And the majority of the work is already done. It helps a lot. Versus asking the sales guy who's already very busy and working on making his quota for the quarter to go and do a bunch more work for marketing. That's one of the tips that I would offer. And you know, like you say, case studies are super valuable, and especially in a startup, you have to have public references because the barrier to entry to a new customer when you're a brand new company is quite high. And case studies are the biggest thing you can do to help with that. And generally, salespeople recognize that. They just may not feel they have the time to drive that. So everything you can do to reduce the amount of time on a salesperson so that you can get these materials done definitely helps.
Absolutely. I think it was because one of the reasons is the salespeople just want to close the deal. So they will do whatever they can to get the business. The thing is, chances are they will be asked for a discount. And I think it was McLaren, the Formula One team, that had this tiered system in its contract saying, okay, I'm buying a piece of kit from you. If you want us to do a press release, this is how much discount we want. If you want a quote or an interview, this is how much discount we want. And they had this system. But what I say to our clients is, turn the tables round. You go to them and you say, because you know they'll ask for a discount, if you would like this level of discount, this is what we would like. And, you know, sometimes salespeople get a little scared that the PR function is going to ask them to get the full monty, you know, case study, press release, interviews, everything. Absolutely not. We will take what we can. Of course, we would like the lot, but we can also just go with an interview, for example, with an executive, or a quote that we can put in the press release. There's always various levels of information that we can work with. And I think it is so important that the in-house team, if that's the way to the salespeople, that the sales guys are told
that
this is the way it can work. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. But so you, Molly Presley, what's the first thing you do when you're given a new piece of tech to
promote? Well, on the case study side, and I just will make one point that I think is really good, Fred, that you made, that it's like you say, it's not all or nothing. If marketing can create the list of, you know, there's probably about 10 different things you can do to promote a case study. You know, can I use just the logo on the website? Can I do, you know, all the way to the whole kit like you were talking about? And generally, customers can support at least one. But, you know, running through PR for a very big company, if your new company is a new customer is a Fortune 100, the PR process is probably 9 months and very complex. So I think you're right. And salespeople, for sure, they don't live in marketing. They don't think about those things. So educate them on all the options available and help the customer to choose is a great idea. The other thing I just always find interesting is often the person who buys the technology will say, sure, we'll be a reference for that discount. And then they find out they didn't have the authority to say that anyway. So you get done and book the deal. And marketing says, you can't do that. What are you talking about? So it's a great conversation to have early. And it's great to have written in the contracts. But then once you get to the point of implementation and the procurement person or the IT person who made that commitment realizes, oh, well, wow, we're in a quiet period. We're not allowed to do PR or whatever the constraint may be, helping them see all the options available, because usually one will fit is a great idea. I just wanted to touch on that because there are ways to navigate that successfully for sure.
Absolutely. Flexibility is the name of the game. At least I always say to our clients, you know, we don't do traditional PR. We don't just go after press or bloggers or analysts. If someone has influence over our clients' customers' buying decisions and they are vendor independent, I will go after them as a possible influencer, as a target, because the editorial landscape is changing so much that you can't just restrict yourself to someone who has editor or journalist or analyst or now blogger in their job title. You would be doing a disservice to your organization. And that actually brings me on to something else, which is this year, A3 Communications turns 20. So we've been looking back at how the data storage industry has changed over the past 20 years. Are there a couple of technology developments that you think have had a huge impact on the data storage industry over the past
20
years?
Yeah, I think the one that's top of mind is the idea that the data center no longer is the center of data. It's not the hub of data. If you look at all the data that's being created in the world, most of it's at the edge. A lot of it needs to be used in the cloud. The data center has its role, whether you call it a private cloud or a data center. The data center continues to have the same role it always had. It's just data has expanded. And so now that the data center isn't the hub or isn't at the center of data, it has changed everything about what storage means. And as a storage PR agency and the focus that you've had, you know, it's blossomed into, it's not just how fast is your kit or how high capacity can you get into a rack. It's about, how do I make that storage accessible and connected to the rest of the world? And I think that's been the biggest change is, okay, lovely, we have sensors and autonomous vehicles. How do you get that data to the storage or the system that's connected to the users who need to access that data? Same thing has happened with the cloud. And so this broad interconnected world has meant that, you know, you have to really think about which data do you have. How do you not just retain it, but how do you use it when it's scattered everywhere? 20 years ago, the whole idea was you put this big monolith system into a data center, and the higher capacity it could be, the better use you would get of power, the higher performance, the better. And that matters still, But that's not the biggest challenge. The biggest challenge is how do you even get the data to that monolith to start with? Because the data is everywhere. I would say that's been the biggest change over the last, you know, decade in particular.
Absolutely. And looking at it from with your marketeer hat on rather than your tech hat on, would you say that today it is harder for you to make your company stand out? Is there more competition? Because there's certainly, you know, we had a huge PR budgets of the 90s, and then we had a dip. And I'm finding that today's the budgets are not necessarily the way they were, obviously with inflation in mind, but there are many, many more companies, many, many more startups engaging PR agencies or having in-house PR. Do you find that today it's easier to do your job than it was when you started out or not?
So my perspective on that is when I started my job, if you were in, there's probably 10, 20 very important publications. And if you could, and they were, it was a pretty consolidated set of where people went and looked and read and learned about things. And if you could be placed in those, that was great. And then the other piece was that you went to a trade show and the bigger presence you could have at the trade show, you know, the larger stand, the more prominent signage, those were the two things really you had to do as a marketeer. And if you were a big enough company or, you know, strategic enough with your PR to be placed in the correct publications and big enough to try by the big stand, you kind of had 90% of your job was done. And that's changed a lot, that now people are going to, you know, 40 or 50 digital locations that sometimes they're blogs, sometimes they're podcasts. There's not that consolidated location where people go to learn. And trade shows aren't that important anymore. I mean, they still occur, but they aren't the primary place people go to learn. The primary place people go to learn, and I think this is a correct statistic, is about 97% of a customer's research is done on your website before they ever even talk to you. You know, so just things have changed. And so, yes, I think it's much more difficult because you have to show up in so many different places with the right message and be differentiated from all the other software companies or technology companies out there who may say the same thing, but not really do it, or say the same thing and be 10 years behind you. So I think it's a much more difficult job now.
I would agree. And that's also why you touched on trade shows. And I find that we've had, it goes in cycles, you know, there was Comdex and all the other big CBIT, all the big generalist shows, then they gave way to the very specific ones. We had S&W Europe, we had Storage Expo, then those went, and now we have the cloud events, the infrastructure events. One thing that really, in a way, is a shame, and it's changed significantly on the PR side, is the fact that because a lot of these events are so general, they don't attract the caliber, in a way, the level of specialist press that they used to in previous years. And this is one of the reasons why we set up Technology Live in 2015, because we wanted to give vendors an opportunity to be able to go to one place and see 15, 20 journalists, analysts, bloggers, brief them, have a really good conversation, and then off they go back home. And I think that's why it's done well, because there isn't anything like that anymore. Not if you really want to see all the key people that you want to brief on.
Yeah, that was kind of a blast of the past, just remembering where we used to have the PR room where we sit and do all of our briefings during the day. And it was, you know, packed with people and all the energy. And you're right, you don't really see that anymore. I hadn't thought about that.
No. We used to get around 70 or 80 targets.
And that was such fun. And you actually got to know the people. And yeah, it was lovely. Yes, it was a lot of work too. Yeah, it's interesting. The part that, and this will sound like a pitch for Technology Live, and in a way it is, but what I really like about it is it is that relationship side. I think part of the reason why, you know, I can get an interview with the journalists or thought leaders personally that I can is in some ways because I was around in the days where you did sit and meet each other in person and have a coffee and talk about something other than just the marketing pitch. And you built those relationships. And that's really absent today in a lot of ways. You know, if you get on a Zoom call, you don't spend the first 20 minutes getting to know each other and talking about hobbies and things like that. And so those relationships haven't been built like they were when we were more. And what Technology Live offers is, it sounds funny, and this is why I tell whatever CFO I'm working with at any given time why we need to do Tech Live is because you get 2 hours with a big group of journalists, and you're not pitching the whole time. You know, they're asking you questions, then they look at each other and challenge each other and say, you know, that's interesting. I don't think about it that way. And it's a conversation, and it's long enough to have a journalist understand, or a blogger, whoever the target audience is, why you do what you do, not just what is the news. And I think that's incredibly valuable because any of us can write a press release and say, we, you know, are announcing this new customer or this new technology, but the why and understanding from different perspectives, the importance of it, you just don't get the time with people anymore. And Technology Live offers that, and it's incredibly valuable. Also, I would mention Tech Live isn't always the same people. You know, in some ways it's very comfortable to show up and see the key journalists that you've spoken to for a very long time. But there's a lot of new influencers showing up in the space that you meet the new person who is coming out of university or maybe used to be an end user and is becoming an influencer. And Tech Live is integrating those people too. And they have a reach into new editorial locations that you may not even be aware of. And that's really valuable as well.
It is. And that I think that's probably why it's grown so quickly. But so looking ahead now, because that's what I like about talking to you. I can talk to you about PR and I can talk to you about tech. Let's look at tech again. What do you think is going to be a very hot data storage technology development in 2023? Is it something that Hammerspace is part of? Is it something else?
I think Hammerspace is onto something pretty incredible with what we're doing. And it is a part of a trend that's really important. And this is really interesting from a marketeer's perspective that I spend a lot of time talking to the big tier one analysts like Gartner and Forrester and groups like that, to customers, to the tech partners, whether it's AWS, Seagate. And there is a problem, and we talked about this earlier, of data is scattered everywhere. It's being generated everywhere. And there aren't the technologies out there today to really handle it. You can market hybrid cloud, multi-cloud, edge, but in the end, a solution to be able to understand the data is being created in place, wherever it's being created, and then move it to where it's needed. And that may be a data center, or it may be a cloud AI engine. That largely doesn't exist today. And yes, that is what Hammerspace does, but it's not just Hammerspace. And so there's this trend of these data-centric architectures that is starting to evolve. And you can see it coming out in customers in that there are chief data architects. There are chief data officers. There in Europe, you see a lot more around, you know, data stewards and things like that. So I think the conversation is going to become more about data and less about storage. And whatever the term in is, and for whoever listens to this podcast or you as very connected PR team, identifying the name of this evolving trend, there's the guys over at who do the cube at SiliconANGLE are calling it super cloud. I've seen the term cloud 3.0 thrown around. Whatever it's going to be called, that's going to be the conversation of what customers need is for all of us as marketing leaders and communication leaders to land on something so they can find out about the technologies that solve this problem. So the problem for a customer, and I talk to customers almost every day at Hammerspace about this, is they say, oh my gosh, I didn't realize a technology had been built that could orchestrate data across my data silos to the applications I need. I was going to build it in-house or continue doing what I was doing in the past, which was put, 5 or 6 technologies together. And they're like, thank goodness I found you. Or, oh gosh, I wish I had found out about this a year ago before we started a development project. While Hammerspace is firmly in the middle of this, many other companies are starting to develop or are on a path to develop something like this as well. Some are storage companies, some are, you know, companies like Snowflake and Databricks. But the customers don't know what to search for. They don't know there's a solution. And it's solves a huge pain point for them that it makes the cloud what I think we all thought it would be when it was first launched, kind of run anything anywhere, run any application on any data anywhere. Well, that's not what the cloud is today because it's not all interconnected. And there are silos of data, silos of applications, et cetera. So that's where I think the big 23 conversation will be is about data architectures, how to make data available when and where you need it, no matter where it was created. And, you know, if you can get a term that gets some critical mass behind it, that would be amazing. But that's the big trend for this year, I believe. Yeah.
The big one. Well, it certainly sounds like 2023 would be a very exciting year Hammerspace. So, Molly, thank you very much for spending time with us today. This brings us to the end of this episode of A3 Communications, Who Do You Think You Are? A reminder for our listeners that you can find the list of podcasts in this series at a3communicationspr.com. I'm Fred Monson. Thank you for listening and see you in our next episode of A3 Communications, Who Do You Think You Are?